clerk will call the docket.
Mitchell Pence, General against Staple Company, Mark A. Schmidt, the accountant, John K. Burke, Jr., the accountant.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Mark Schmidt. I represent Mitchell Canvas in this case. This case is a sanctions case, and to jump right into a little roadmap, the points that I want to emphasize this morning are that the court weighed the incorrect factors below. She dwelled on factors such as certain intent to intimidate and awareness of the extent of the litigation, and these are not the correct factors for evaluating a sanctions motion.
Say that again.
She weighed the improper factors.
And what were they?
She focused on that Mr. Canvas had a certain level to intimidate and that he was aware of the extent of the litigation. And the statute says the court can consider improper factors such as harassment and a drive to unnecessarily drive up costs.
Do you draw a major distinction between the words intimidate and harass?
I do.
Well, I'd love to hear it.
Well, litigation is inherently intimidating. When you file a suit against someone for $1 million or any amount that is significant to them, there is intimidation. If a complaint isn't intimidating when you read it, it probably hasn't been well drafted. Intimidation simply says it puts an aspect of fear into the case, and fear is inherent in legal proceedings.
But it's obviously a matter of degree.
And the judge in this case, she said a certain level of intent to intimidate.
In other words, at a certain point of arguable frivolity and bad faith, you have to draw the line somewhere.
Indeed you do. Now, just to not use all my time on my roadmap, if I may, I understand the point you're making, and we'll address that more, but to get the rest of my roadmap out here, the second thing she did relates into that from my perspective is that she didn't talk about the improper delay, improper costs, the things that are referenced in the statute. And then three, even if I am incorrect on that first point about intimidation being different than an improper purpose, the count that she chose to focus upon, and she chose to focus upon the counts that went forward at the trial on September 23rd, which were non-suited, and count two for fraud was dismissed with or without prejudice. There was no ruling as to prejudice. She focused on those things, and she awarded sanctions related to the amount that the defendants had asked for the fraud count. The defendants had asked for $79,541.62 in connection with this fraud count, which was dismissed at the trial. And she awarded exactly to the penny $5,000 more. And then she awarded them, saying this was the cost of the trial and the cost of moving forward. Clearly, there's a connection here. She is focusing on count two of the Third Amendment complaint for fraud. And if you look at the history of that fraud count, it was in the complaint. It was in the amended complaint. There was never a hearing on this. It was in the second amended complaint. There was a demur to it. It survived demur. There was a motion for summary judgment to it. It survived a motion for summary judgment. So the court ruled on it twice and said it's sufficient to go forward. When Mr. Canvas is going to trial on September 23rd of 2013, on the way to trial, he loses his counsel. He's unable to, evidently there's a dispute as to payment. He's unable to pay him, and he loses his counsel. He goes forward. He puts together his trial book. There's extensive motions in limine heard on the day of trial. And in the
motions, he was pro se at that point in time?
He was pro se at this point in time. So he went forward pro se. And he loses the majority of these motions in limine. He loses an expert witness. He loses his evidence about damages. He gets throttled by these motions in limine. He decides he wants to non-sue. Now, the court, because he's pro se, attempted to protect him by having him discuss his case with counsel that happened to be in the courtroom. But nonetheless, he decides he can't go forward. And there's extensive dialogue between him and the court where he says, you know, I'd like to go forward, but this is just too much. I can't do this without counsel. And he says, you know, I want a non-suit. I want a punt. The court doesn't permit it. The court permits it with there's a count for battery, a count for outrage, and what have you. But on this fraud count, the court doesn't permit it. There was evidently a counterclaim.
How could he win the fraud count? The fraud count is, she promised me half of this, and I didn't get it, and yet there's an assignment of membership interest for the LLC that appears to be complete. And how could there be a win here at all?
Well, there was also a document that purports, that's signed by Ms. Constantine, that purports to give him monies in the proceeds of properties, half of an interest in the primary lot that they had built their home on, $1.5 million home.
But am I right, the fraud count is seeking 50% of Villa Death Day LLC, is that right?
The fraud count is seeking an interest in Villa Death Day's assets.
Okay, well then, how does that fraud count survive what appears to be a fully intact assignment of interest?
Well, the judge had ruled that it survived.
No, put that aside. Judges do that all the time, allow matters to go forward without giving an ultimate ruling. How does the fraud count in any forum win when there is a one-page signed, unchallenged document that says that 100% of this was assigned?
Well, the document is challenged in the degree that that document was signed on January 6th, and there's two documents.
One December 31 is the one I'm looking at.
December 31st.
Yeah.
And there's a second document which Mr. Camus had pled was given in exchange for that document, that the two documents were simultaneously executed. He pleaded that in the Second Amendment complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the judge said, no, you know, they're standalone. You know, one's on January 6th, one's on December 31st. However, when Mr. Campus brought these counts and complaints, his allegations were the two documents were given, one for the other, that there was consideration given for the document which gave him rights in the proceeds and the land.
So he could sue for that, but he couldn't sue, as I'm reading this document, for the Villa d'Este LLC membership interest. And yet that's what I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the fraud count was seeking.
Well, I think the fraud count was seeking the monetary, half the monetary proceeds from Villa d'Este.
Okay.
I think the fraud count was a little bit broader than simply looking for a half membership interest in Villa d'Este.
Do you think the fact that the fraud count survived a MRR, it means that sanctions couldn't be awarded for it? Could not the trial judge still award sanctions if the claim was facially meritorious, at least to the extent that it survived a MRR, but it was brought for an improper purpose, such as intimidation?
Well, the fraud count also survived summary judgment, meaning that there had to be a scintilla. The court found that there
Everything
was a scintilla
survived
evidence.
Survived summary judgment in Virginia.
You do have to have a scintilla of evidence. I mean, there has to be something. If there's nothing, you should lose on summary judgment.
But isn't the statute, when an attorney signs a pleading, excuse me, or makes a motion, it's a representation that it's well-grounded in fact and law, or a good faith argument for the advancement of the law, and it's not made for an improper purpose. So it's, I would think that you could have a meritorious claim that would still be sanctionable if the purpose of it were improper.
The closest the judge comes to finding an improper purpose is she says there was a certain level of intent to intimidate. And again, that she doesn't say that it was an improper purpose. She says there's a certain level to intimidate. And again, litigation is inherently intimidating.
Can she look at the overall 250-some paragraph complaint and say there is an improper level of intimidation in this entire complaint, and it is telescoped into this count that actually went to trial?
Well, theoretically she could, but what you have in this case here is she does address numerous of the counts that were in the complaint, and she allocates them entirely to her counsel, to Mr. Canvas's counsel at that time. The 19 counts, 13 of them were dismissed at the end of the Second Amendment complaint at the demur to it. And she attributed some, she says, the mechanics lien wasn't sanctionable, the breach of contract wasn't sanctionable, the conspiracy wasn't sanctionable, the plebeian defamation, they were sanctionable, but they had a de minimis impact. And then she attributes to the Zobrist law firm the derivative claims and an appeal. So she does. She parcels through this complaint, and she hands it to the Zobrist law firm, who did not follow through with their appeal. Then she turns to Mr. Canvas and says, I find a certain level of intent to intimidate. And again, she doesn't say that it was for an improper purpose.
Well, why else would she be commenting on that, other than to address the statutory factors?
I think she needed to be clear. Because again, that fraud count, on her own ruling, survived demur, and it survived summary judgment. You can't survive summary judgment without some evidence.
But, counsel, it seems to me that perhaps you're reading the three elements on which a court can award sanction as if they all have to be present. Why can't the court say, when you file this, perhaps it was colorable, could go forward, but you filed it with the intent to intimidate, and therefore I'm going to sanction you? Wouldn't that be inappropriate?
Well, when you look at the history of this fraud count, the court, beyond the summary judgment, the court doesn't hear evidence at the time of the trial. At the time of the trial, what happens is Mr. Canvas loses his expert, loses evidentiary rulings, loses his evidence as to damages, as to the value of these properties. So the only additional information after that summary judgment ruling that the judge had was Mr. Canvas procedurally is not able to go forward with the evidence he thought he was able to go forward with. That's the additional information she learns. And based on that, afterwards, there's this issue about it, whether it was dismissed with prejudice or without prejudice. She makes no ruling. Mr. Burke later moves to have it classified with prejudice, and Canvas opposes, which would make sense that he would. You know, that can't be held against him. He wasn't the one who decided to enter an order with or without prejudice. There's no additional information after the summary judgment ruling that could be considered sanctionable. So everything she knew about the fraud count, she knew at the end of the summary judgment ruling where she ruled it could go forward and set it for trial. She set it for trial. And well,
maybe
she didn't hear more evidence.
Maybe she should have dismissed it on summary judgment. What does that matter now?
And maybe she should have, but she didn't. And therefore, she made a decision. It had enough merit, it had enough evidence in its favor to get to trial. And then at trial, it didn't get dismissed because it didn't have evidence.
But you're presupposing she should have not granted the summary judgment. If she should have, and for whatever reason didn't, and there can be lots of reasons in a circuit court practice like this, two wrongs don't make a right. You don't go, well, I probably should have granted this earlier, so I'm going to not grant sanctions now when it's obviously being asserted for the wrong reason.
She should have made that more clear in her ruling. Because all she does in the ruling, she doesn't, if you look at all the cases that were cited, all these sanctions cases, they all are very particular.
If she said the things that you think she should have said, the trial judge, would you be on appeal? So are we arguing about what she said or what she did?
Both. One, what she said was improper and incorrect. Two, if you look at the fraud count, it did have evidence to support it through demur and through summary judgment. And it only was dismissed at the trial because Mr. Canvas was impaired when he was pro se by losing his experts and his evidence as to damages.
What about what she said was improper and incorrect? You come back to what she said was improper and incorrect. I still haven't heard what was improper and incorrect about what she said.
Well, instead of saying that it was interposed for an improper purpose, she says there was a certain level to intimidate, and Mr. Camus was aware of the extent of the litigation. Litigants should be aware of the extent of the litigation.
Okay, that's your position. I understand what you're saying.
And litigation is inherently intimidating. It's not an improper purpose to intimidate the other side.
But it is, would you agree that it might be an improper purpose to intentionally attempt to intimidate the other side beyond the inherent intimidation of
litigation? No, Your Honor. When you draft a complaint, you intend to let the other side know they're in trouble. You intend for them, to a certain degree, to quake in their boots and realize, you know, yes, I'm going to lose, and I need to capitulate or settle. That's part of drawing up a pleading, is to make sure the other side understands that they are at risk.
Counsel, this is a time for questions and answers. I just have to say, though, I fundamentally disagree with what you just said.
Sorry, Judge.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Justice. Justices.
May it please the Court. My name is John Burke of the firm.
You may sit at counsel table. Counsel table.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
That's quite all right. Restart the clock.
May it please the Court. My name is John Burke of the firm of Sutliff and Holland, and I'm here today on behalf of the Appellees. Before I jump into the sanctions discussion, I want to first mention the assignment of cross error that the Circuit Court erred in reinstating the memorandum of this pending this appeal. That issue is basically moot because this Court didn't grant any of the assignments of error related to the claims that arguably related to the real estate. However, the Circuit Court entered an order that was attached at the end of our brief that reinstated the memorandum of list pending the appeal. Now that all of the claims relating to the real estate have not only been dismissed by the Circuit Court, but this Court refused to grant the appeal, that memorandum of list pendants needs to be released. Canvas and his corporations have refused to do that, and so I request on behalf of the appellant, of the appellees, that this Court remand the case to the Circuit Court with instruction to enter an order to be recorded in the land records of the Circuit Court of Albemarle County, releasing the memorandum of list pendants and vacating the order that she entered in February of 2014, reinstating the list pendants pending the appeal.
Mr. Burke, I understand your argument completely, and I think you're right. But I don't think we can tell the Circuit Court to do anything on a matter that we didn't grant. That's the problem. You may get a remand, but I don't think we're in a position to tell the Court to do anything on an issue that's not before us.
Well, Your Honor, the Court did grant the assignment of cross error, but then because it didn't grant any of the Canvas parties' appeals of the Circuit Court's ruling relating to the real estate, the issue is moot because there's nothing left for the list pendants to do.
Well, I suspect you're right about that, but go ahead with the rest of your argument.
Thank you. No surprise, the appellees submit that the Circuit Court did not abuse its discretion in imposing sanctions pursuant to Virginia Code Section 8.01-271.1 against Mr. Canvas, and that the Circuit Court's finding that count two was filed for an improper purpose is not clearly erroneous. Now, I don't think I need to elaborate on the point that opposing counsel argued about intimidation. The statute mentions that it's sanctionable to file a claim, even a meritorious claim, for any improper purpose. It uses the words improper purpose, and then it says such as harassment and to increase the cost of the litigation. So I don't think it can be argued that intimidation is not an improper purpose. And the Court certainly was implying that when she stated that there was this level of intent to intimidate, and that her comments about Mr. Canvas knowing the extent of the litigation got to the issues of increasing the cost unnecessarily on behalf of the Considine parties. And those statements by the court are at pages 608 and 609 of the appendix. I also want to clear up another issue, and that is Mr. Canvas showed up on the day of trial ready to try the case, and I submit that the record doesn't support that. Mr. Canvas, in fact, had filed a motion to non-suit 3 days before the trial of the case. So he intended to non-suit the case. Unfortunately for him, at the trial, the circuit court denied the motion to non-suit because there was a counterclaim pending which couldn't stand alone for independent adjudication. That's when he moved to continue the case. The court denied that. That's when he moved to voluntarily dismiss it. The court also noted that Mr. Canvas' loss of counsel was of his own making. Opposing counsel intimated that counsel was lost shortly before trial, and that is true in terms of when the order was entered. But the motion by the law firm to withdraw was made at least 3 or 4 months before the trial. And there were several hearings on that, but the court didn't grant leave to withdraw. But in the meantime, the record shows Mr. Canvas failed to pay the law firm while at the same time demanding that they provide extra personnel to prosecute his case. And that is what the circuit court meant by that situation of losing counsel was solely of his own making.
Well, I think as well, she said something about being aware of the extent of the litigation. He certainly was aware enough to know that he couldn't pay his lawyers as a result of it. Maybe the other party couldn't pay their lawyers either. Now, I've reviewed this record in its entirety. And what happened in this case is a romantic relationship went south. And with it was all the business entanglements. And this trial judge was wise enough to realize that there was more going on in this courtroom than just legal issues. And I think she was very polite about it. I think she was very discreet about it. But I think she was also very clear about it. There was another motive for this litigation.
I don't disagree, Your Honor. I think the chart on page 479 just shows of the appendix, it just shows the extent of the litigation. 17 counts in count one, 19 counts in count two, a third amended complaint. We don't even list the first amended complaint because that got a little lost in the shuffle. But as an indication of what Chief Justice Lemons was referring to, I doubt there's any case pending in this court where there have been 4 complaints. The original complaint, amended complaint, a second amended complaint, and a third amended complaint. The behavior of a plaintiff and his counsel throughout the entire case was just outrageous, and time doesn't permit me. It's all in the brief, but it doesn't permit me to explain all of that, except maybe the most egregious, which is typical, is in the original complaint they had some counts based on alleged breach of verbal contracts. And then in responsive pleadings, we raised the statute of limitations, and all of a sudden the same claims were contained in the second amended complaint, except the contracts, instead of being verbal, were alleged to be written. And that's just typical. A conspiracy count against Ms. Considine and her 80-year-old mother, now 85, who's still in this case after, she's not in the case, she's been dismissed, but the case is still pending after 6 years. And her only sin, as shown by the record, is that she lent over $2 million to Mr. Canvas and Ms. Considine, which has not yet been repaid, and yet she was sued for conspiracy. So, Your Honor, I guess that's a long way. I should have just said I agree, but I can't help myself.
Counsel, was the trial judge, it seems to me, was considering all of that at the time that the sanctions were awarded. I mean, all that was left standing of the case was the fraud count, but she didn't award sanctions just based on the fraud count. She awarded sanctions based on the entire course of litigation, did she not?
Well, Your Honor, she didn't really articulate why. I think that was certainly the context of the litigation. She had certainly observed it for a long time, and I'm sure that influenced her. And she went to great lengths, as my opponent pointed out, to say that on some counts she said, well, I dismissed it, but I don't think it was sanctionable, or at least one of them, she said, I think it's sanctionable, but it really wasn't hard for you to get dismissed, so I'm not going to award sanctions. Now, she never said specifically that the dollar amount was pegged to count two, but counsel for appellants is correct. It is exactly $5,000 more than what was sought for count two. And I think the $5,000, she didn't say it, but we had also asked, and there's authority supporting it, for not only the legal fees incurred in defending these counts, but also the substantial fees incurred in obtaining the sanctions, which the courts say is recoverable as well. I'd also like to get to the fraud count. It's misleading to say that the fraud count survived demurrers. In fact, there was no ruling on demurra on this fraud count, and there was no argument presented to the circuit court at the demurra stage for the fraud counts. It was the subject of motion for summary judgment, which the circuit court denied, and quite frankly, she did that because she said that, as circuit judges often do, there may be facts that relate to this which aren't in the record, so I'm going to deny the motion for summary judgment. My argument to her was that there may be facts, but they're not material facts, because I think the law is very clear in Virginia that you can't have reasonable reliance, which is required for fraud, on oral misrepresentations which are completely contradicted by the plain terms of a written agreement. And of course, as Justice Kelsey pointed out, we have this assignment of membership interest, which is in the appendix. I think it's at page 48, which couldn't be clearer that this Mr. Canvas assigned all of his interest in Villa d'Este to Ms. Considine. And with respect to the other document that Mr. Schmidt referred to, if you read count two of the third amended complaint, that fraud count doesn't even refer to this other document. And the
perhaps
reason for that is...
Perhaps the second thread of narrative here is that trial judges dismiss cases on demurrer and dismiss cases on summary judgment when it was proper to do so, we wouldn't find ourselves in a situation where litigants are backed up on the day of trial and sanction motions are flying around. Maybe that's the real lesson from this case.
I don't disagree, Your Honor. I will note that, you know, there are some cases that, you know, admonish circuit courts for granting summary judgment, at least my own experience. So I think the circuit courts have taken that to heart too much.
Perhaps.
Particularly when you have a document like we have in this case, that it should have been granted.
Well, I think Justice Mims pointed out earlier that a circuit court judge who grants summary judgment as a circuit court judge is going to be reversed very quickly by this court, but perhaps we should soften up a bit on that.
Well, I would certainly be in favor of that, Your Honor. To the point raised by Justice Roush and Justice Powell, the statute itself provides, as you all pointed out, I think, that regardless of the merits of a claim, if it's asserted for an improper purpose, such as to intimidate, harass, increase the cost of litigation, sanctions are appropriate. And this court has recognized that in the Oxenham case that we cited. We also cited two federal cases under Rule 11, which is substantially similar to Virginia Code Section 8.01,
271.1. Counsel, may I ask a question about the crosshair before you run out of time? You say it's moot, but then you actually want us to have it released and vacated. And so that's an unusual position to take, and I'm trying to understand that. The other thing is all the assignments of that were refused, it's not obvious from the face of the assignments that they have anything to do with the property. And I'm trying to figure out why it was filed in the beginning. I know you say it was improperly filed in the beginning. Is it because of it was the assets that were on Villa d'Este? Is that?
Your Honor, to be completely candid, there may have been a claim in the original complaint, I can't specifically recall, that arguably may have justified the filing of the memorandum of list pendants. in the sense that it was went to the title of real estate. However, by the time the second amended complaint was filed, I agree with you. None of those counts related to title to real estate. And so when the demurrer to the most of the second amended complaint was granted, the court entered an order dismissing the memorandum of list pendants. A year later, close to the end of this case, the canvas parties made a motion to reinstate the memorandum of list pendants and to vacate the order which had released it, which the circuit court granted. We argued the judge it isn't appropriate to do that, even if the counts which you dismissed did relate to real estate, we would say you shouldn't reinstate it. But in this case, because it's so clear, as Your Honor pointed out, that none of the claims in the second amended complaint related to title to real estate, there was no basis for the list pendants in the first place, and so it seemed completely unfair and quite frankly kind of nonsensical to reinstate the list pendants pending the appeal of claims that didn't relate to real estate. But nevertheless, that's what the judge did, and we attached the order vacating the list pendants at the end of our brief. So,
well, under the statute, do you think you would have an automatic right to request that the circuit court judge release the list pendants? Because under the statute is about a valid list pendants being filed and being in place until the end of an appeal.
Your Honor, I think I've run out now.
Go right ahead and answer the question.
Your Honor, the way this came about, where it was originally released and then when the appeal was imminent, the circuit court granted their motion to reinstate the list pendants. We didn't have the circuit court wouldn't release it at that point. So in the assignment of cross error, quite frankly, what we wanted this court to do was, and we asked for this in the assignment of cross error, to immediately release the list pendants because none of the claims that were appealed related to title to real estate, and so it shouldn't remain the list pendants shouldn't remain in place pending the appeal. But then now that didn't happen, but the court didn't grant the appeal with respect to any of those claims, even though they didn't relate to real estate, the list pendants is still there. And so I think the only way justice can be done is to remand it, and as I pointed out when I was speaking with the Chief Justice at the beginning, there was this assignment of cross error on the list pendants, and I think it has to be remanded to the circuit court for her to now enter an order vacating her order, which vacated the list pendants.
But if you prevail, that would be your position before the circuit court, correct? If you prevail, we won. Vacate it.
Yes, but the only thing I worry about is if this court doesn't remand it to the circuit court,
right,
we may get met with some kind of res judicata argument that you're filing a new.
Yeah, I guess the question, I don't mean to speak for Justice McClanahan, but I know I am reluctant to direct a circuit court judge to do something that is within their province rather than ours in the posture of the case. You may be right, and we'll certainly consider your request, and I'm only one of seven up here, but I know my colleague well enough to know that she has the same concern that I do, directing trial judges to do things that they ought to do as opposed to us. That's the only question that we're asking her.
May I respond?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, I would just respond to that, but it seems to me that similar things happen all the time. For instance, where a circuit court doesn't award attorney's fees, maybe where a contract provided for it, this court will remand it to the circuit court with direction to award fees and to hold a hearing on the amount of those fees. So I really don't see the difference in this case. And
If you prevailed in this litigation and we didn't address the remand issue, couldn't you just make a motion with the circuit court, motion to release lease pendants?
I would certainly hope so. I think it would have to be in the form of a new case because this case will be over if you dismiss it. And given the six-year history of this litigation.
No, that's the difference. And the premise of her question is if we remanded the case.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes, sir.
But the idea is to remand it without directions and let you pursue whatever remedy you would want.
Well, that would certainly that would be acceptable. Of course, I'd prefer that it be clear, because given the history, Your Honor, and we've asked that they release it, they won't do it, and so I'm just afraid if there's any uncertainty.
Well, if you prevail in this case on this record, and you end up getting some of the same behavior that you have detailed in your brief, I'm sure you'll be asking the circuit court for more than release of the Liz pendants.
That's correct, Your Honor, but in 37 years of practicing law, I found that there's a big difference between getting a judgment for money and collecting that money.
that may be so.
that's a problem here.
I'm sure you want finality at some point.
Exactly.
All right. Call the next case.
Thank you very much.